Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Yesterday was Selection Sunday, the day the NCAA reveals the 68 teams that will participate in the Men's and Women's College Basketball Championship. For many of us, it is indeed the most wonderful time of the year, March Madness. This year's tournament comes at a time of dramatic changes in college sports. Athletes can now be paid through name, image, and likeness agreements, or NIL, something that many, including legendary coaches Nick Saban and Mike Krzyzewski, have criticized. And most recently, the Dartmouth basketball team actually voted to unionize. We're lucky to be joined by someone with a unique perspective on what is happening in college sports, the former chief operating officer and chief legal officer of the NCAA, Don Remy. Good morning, Don. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, good morning, Roger. Good morning, Allison. Thank you for having me on the show. Ironically, I'm coming to you from Indiana, the home state of the NCAA headquarters. And before we get started, I just want to offer a congrats to your state's teams, BYU and Utah State on the men's side and Utah on the women's side for a great season. Good luck in the tournament to you guys.
All right. So, Don, this is big business. Can we talk a little bit about the financial aspects of March Madness? What are the revenue sources for the tournament, and how is the money ultimately distributed?
You know, although we're celebrating our young men and women basketball success right now, I'm so happy your show is focused on the money in college sports because it's much needed. And the financial aspects of March Madness have to be understood in the bigger picture. And many people think about football, and you mentioned Nick Saban in your intro, and it's important to understand what many of your listeners may not be tracking on. The money generated by the college football playoff and bowl media rights agreements, that's around $460 million annually for the current structure, and reported to be about $1.3 billion annually for the expanded structure, is not part of the NCAA revenue generation or its distribution. The NCAA receives most of its billion-dollar-plus annual revenue from two sources, roughly $945 million from television and media rights and another $225 million from championship ticket sales. That money, you ask about distribution, Roger, that money is distributed in all kinds of ways, probably about a dozen or so ways. Think about scholarship and support for all the different men's and women's sports, hosting championships events. There's a portion that's distributed to schools and conferences based on athletic and academic success. There's money given to student-athlete services like emergency student assistance if you need money for a coat or things like that, or athlete catastrophic insurance, drug testing. And Division II and Division III programming and services are supported by the NCAA Constitution, by this generation of revenue, 4.37% to Division II, 3.18% to Division III, and then we'll probably get into this. You talk about legal expenses and conventions and meetings and all of the discussions, the general administrative NCAA expenses. And then finally, there's educational programming for conferences and campus athletics administrators.
So one of the questions I have is, do the individual participants in the tournaments, the men's and women's tournaments, do they get extra money from the NCAA for participating?
Sure, the schools do. The conferences do. There's some money that's distributed through the conferences and some money that's distributed directly to the schools for their participation and their success in the tournament. And some of that, as I think I mentioned at a little while ago, is actually tied to their academic performance as well.
Okay. And the big television contract, because obviously, what are we going to see? Some 63 games, all of which I think are televised. What kind of revenue is generated from that television contract alone for the men's and women's basketball?
Yeah, so the men's and the women's basketball contracts are separate. And the men's contract is with CBS and Turner. The women's contract is with ESPN. And so you have to divide those up. And the women's contract is combined with all of the other sports that ESPN produces and delivers.
With regards to then the funds that each individual school receives, how important is this revenue for the individual college programs?
It's exceedingly important. This is how the schools, the colleges and universities run their athletics programs in many instances. Sure, there are some big schools that can generate revenue on their own through their own media rights and their own ticket sales. But a huge number of schools in Divisions 2 and 3 for sure, and in Division 1 as well, utilize the revenue through this media rights contract with the NCAA tournament to fund all of their programming together with some of the money that comes from the college football playoff.
And is there any benefit towards other types of sports, such as Olympic sports or women's sports, as part of this?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. You know, all of the Olympic sports, many of the women's sports are funded exclusively through the distributions that are made out of this model. Those are not revenue-generating programs for the most part, and even the revenue that they do generate wouldn't be sufficient to sustain all of the programming that we have for our Olympic athletes, many of whom are trained on our college campuses, and our women's sports that occur in all three divisions.
So there's currently only 68 teams, you know, put within the format of March Madness. Has there been any pressure to expand that?
Yeah, that's a good question, Allison. You know, people have talked about expansion from 68 to 72 to 80 or even to 96. It's been talked about in the past. It's been rejected. And I'm no longer in the room where those conversations are happening, and I'm not sure what's driving the NCAA or the conference leadership or the basketball committee to consider this stuff again. I don't know if it's, you know, more money in media rights or more money to conference and school participants, if it's an effort to include more big programs in the tournament, or simply a desire to have more teams and athletes enjoy this magical moment. I don't know what the reason is, but no matter the reason, you know, I agree with Jay Billis on this one. It is an unequivocally bad idea.
I do have to ask, as a matter of logic, 64 is, you know, a number that is related to 2. 68 is not. How did they go from 64 to 68, and why?
Great question, Roger. It was an expansion to provide more opportunities for more student athletes and to produce it in this format of the early rounds of the tournament. Some people call them the play-in games. You know, basketball will start on Tuesday. And Thursday of this week, with some games being played in Dayton, and then they play into the bigger tournament. But at the end of the day, it was designed to allow a greater level of accessibility to the tournament.
So we started to talk a little bit about big business in college sports. For years, there were strict limits on providing anything of value to NCAA athletes other than an education. I think Reggie Bush ended up having his Heisman yanked, you know, because of receiving some rather relatively modest financial gains. What are the implications of, you know, the legal structure in terms of things changing? Like, let's start with the Alston case. How did that change things with respect to athlete compensation?
Yeah, there's a lot there. You know, of course, portions of the American college sports enterprise are big business. That's undeniable. That's always been the case. And as you know, college sports, they're inextricably bound to higher education. And I think most importantly, what folks should understand about the college sports system is it operates on this recruiting design. And that's something that no other sports league has. And it's what drives many of the NCAA rules and restrictions that you're seeing being challenged in court. And it's this never-ending quest by the members of the association to figure out the right balance and the right fairness opportunities there. So Alston, that was the Supreme Court case that ruled that the NCAA could not restrict non-cash educational-related benefits, things like post-eligibility scholarships or tutoring or study abroad or post-eligibility internships, those things. And basically, the court said, hey, NCAA, you say you're about education. Put your money where your mouth is. And don't restrict what athletes can receive that should be tethered to education. That was not a case about NIL at all. It was a case about educationally related benefits. And now you're seeing more benefits being provided to student athletes. That NCAA NIL rule was published, you know, shortly after that decision. So many people think it was related, but it had been in the works for a little while. And it was much more complicated initially than people thought.
Okay, so let's outline the NIL rule that did come out. How did it work, and is it working as it was supposed to?
Well, and the other thing is NIL is name, image, likeness. So I just got to go there.
Thank you. Thank you, Allison. Yes, name, image, and likeness rule. You know, it's something that the association had thought about for a while, but couldn't find the right answers given the complexities of making a decision to allow athletes to receive money for their name, image, and likeness and have that be consistent with this quote-unquote amateur model of athletics. So right after the Supreme Court issued its decision, the NCAA rolled out, I think it was June 2021, the last day of the month, a condensed format of a rule that would allow student-athletes to receive these benefits. And in part, it was a condensed format because the DOJ Antitrust Division had concerns about the direction they were going to go and the restrictions they were going to place on it. And there was a patchwork of more than a dozen state laws that were going to take effect on July 1st. And those laws would have allowed college athletes to begin activities like making endorsement deals and leveraging their social media for pay, which a lot of people do already anyway. And the idea at the time, you asked, what was it supposed to do? It was supposed to provide this avenue for student athletes to receive these benefits, to receive compensation for their name, image, and likeness, and then they would develop the guardrails around it over time. It would be a temporary measure that could be tinkered and strengthened later. What you see now is, as the NCAA has tried to put those guardrails in and strengthen this, is the courts are not going to allow that strengthening, and the NCAA seems to have temporarily at least abandoned enforcement.
You know, when you first heard about it, I had this vision of, you know, a local athlete in a town being endorsing the local burger joint, right? And that seemed to me to be sort of one level of things. But instead, what we've seen are these large conglomerates that they kind of remind me of political action committees. They sort of ostensibly are separate from the university, but somehow I think there's a connection. And they're raising massive amounts of money. And these NIL deals, a lot of them don't seem to be tied to actually marketing the image and likeness of the athlete.
You're exactly right. They're called collectives, and this isn't an enterprise that has grown up around providing these name, image, and likeness opportunities to the athletes. But they can range everywhere from the local car dealership or burger joint to multi-billion-dollar corporations. And you see this endorsement money flowing into the student athletes at a point in time where their marketability is probably at its highest, but in amounts that I don't think were imagined when they initially rolled out the rule.
We do see some strange things. I think here in Utah, the University of Utah athletes get cars for the year, something that I can't imagine. I'm having trouble tying to an actual name, image, and likeness deal. And you read things like every lineman at one of the Texas universities getting, you know, $80,000 in NIL deals. It really has exploded, hasn't it?
It has. It has. And it's gone, like I said, it's gone beyond what was anticipated. And really now, what you're in is you're in a space where it's tantamount to pay for play.
Yeah.
What do you think of Nick Saban's comments lamenting the state of college sports and liking it to a free agent, free for all?
Yeah, you know, in a word, he's right. Or I guess that's two words, right? You know, on Coach Saban, you got to think, he's been a prolific, successful college football coach. On the field, but he's also been committed to the success of his players in life. And, you know, don't take my word for that. Ask his players. I know him, and I totally understand his comments and where he's coming from. And he and others, he's not the only coach that has come out and said, we've got challenges here. You think about in we're talking March Madness now, Coach K, another wildly successful coach, in this instance, men's basketball. They said, look, these rules, not the NIL rules, have, as I said earlier, devolved into a proxy for pay to play. And the transfer rules, we hadn't talked about those, they've created a kind of free agency on steroids. So you add that to the insatiable appetite for money in college sports at all levels and all participants. I think we've forever changed the landscape and made sure that the glorified notions of amateurism that were once held dear are dead, or at least they're failing on life support.
And it doesn't sound like the courts would let them come back either, does it?
Well, if you read Kavanaugh's concurring opinion in the Supreme Court Alston case, that's certainly the impression you get.
I want to touch on the Dartmouth situation. I know a few years back, Northwestern football tried to unionize, and now apparently the Dartmouth basketball team has decided to unionize. It seemed a little strange to me when I thought about the fact that they don't even have scholarships. What do you think of the notion of college athletes unionizing?
Yeah, it's hard to tell where this thing is going. You know, there's a group called the National College Players Association. They've been around for like 20 years. There's a College Athletes Players Association. They've been around for a decade. And I know they're going to continue to fight for athletes' rights and unionization no matter what happens in these cases. That said, you know, this model that they're advocating for, a compensated, unionized, collective bargaining employee unit, it's hard to see how that's workable in a nationwide athletic system that's made up of state and private colleges and universities. And, we don't have the time on this call to talk about all the challenges with that, but those challenges are going to be explored in this Dartmouth case as it proceeds through the system. And you mentioned the Northwestern case that came along earlier. They were recognized. The issues were recognized in that case. And so, you know, sure. The non-scholarship basketball players at Dartmouth raised their hand and they said, at this private Ivy League school, we're going to vote to unionize. And the NLRB recognized their ability to vote. They opined that they were employees. They certified a union and the schools appealed that now. And Roger, you know how the legal system works. It'll be years before we know the final answer. It'll be years.
Just to make sure our audience understands, Is it an administrative procedure in front of the NLRB? Is that what happens now? Or do they go to court?
That is where they are. That is where they are now. They have appealed to the full NLRB. But I suspect this thing is destined for the court system.
So unions are just one challenge of many. Other ones include the transfer portal. We talked a little bit about the collectives, coaches' salaries and buyouts, conference realignment, concussions, rules enforcement. And essentially, just even the rules themselves and just plain compensation and revenue sharing, there's a lot. Can college sports be fixed?
Yeah, you know, the issues plaguing college sports, they're seemingly endless and undeniably complicated. There's those you've mentioned. There's things like sports wagering. We haven't talked about that right now. But, you know, the courts are certifying nationwide antitrust classes. Seems like every other month, states are making their own rules. There's athlete activism, which is at an all-time high. It's a good thing. There's a system that very few nowadays believe is fair. Higher education itself is under assault, right? Something's got to give in order to maintain this fair and balanced national landscape. And self-governance at the NCAA, to say the least, has proved to be really, really challenging for the membership. And understand, that's in part because the membership of that association, it doesn't enjoy this monolithic perspective, right, where there are common answers to complex questions. You're talking about athletics programs with budgets that range from $250 million in Division I to less than $500,000 in Division III. An organization that's operating in all 50 states in Canada. Heck, to make matters even worse and even more complicated, you have a school in the tournament that's part of a publicly traded company. You got a nonprofit school in the tournament that owns and funds a huge for-profit online academic service. So the national office, the conferences, the schools, yeah, they've taken this discussion to Congress to try to find this national legislative solution. As you mentioned earlier, the courts don't seem like they're willing to allow the membership of the NCAA to make its own rules without those rules being challenged and invalidated every time you turn around a corner. But the problem with going to Congress, it's
Congress.
Yeah. No need to say more.
you mentioned wagering and, you know, the prolific increase in public wagering and the ability to wager, and the fact that when you look at sort of almost any discussion of an upcoming game, the betting line is included, and it's very easy to do online. Do you think it's likely we're going to head for another sort of point shaving or similar gambling related scandal? I noticed that there was some issue around strange betting lines moving around surrounding Temple basketball last week. Isn't some kind of problem like that inevitable?
You know, God, I hope that the systems that we have in place that can detect, prevent in the first place, and detect and remediate these types of things are working and working well. For years, you couldn't engage in sports wagering outside of Vegas under a law called PASPA. Supreme Court, again, got in the mix in this one and invalidated that and opened up sports betting, not just on college sports, but on all professional sports across the board. And you're right. What you now see is the betting line is being talked about alongside, you know, the conversations around the game and the contest and the players and the like. You know, I know that the college sports environment as well as the professional sports environment have put things in place, technology in place, people in place to try to avoid those scandals. But we'll see how it plays out. You know, nowadays the athletes are receiving more compensation through NIL, and hopefully that takes away some of the steam that those in the gambling industry may have previously thought they had with athletes to impact games.
Where do you think the landscape of college sports, or what do you think the landscape of college sports will look like in the next 5 years?
Nothing like it does now. or anything that it's looked like in the past. We've talked about this. The courts, the regulators, the state legislators, they're defining college sports policy instead of universities and athletics executives and administrators. And it's really a coin toss at best whether the NCAA can have the United States Congress step in and create a rational framework. So what does it mean? I think it means ultimately the markets will define the future of college sports. Within the next few years, maybe even sooner, we might have a unionized workforce of athletes who are compensated employees of private entities, not the universities, not the conferences, not the NCAA, compensated employees of private entities who license marks and lease facilities from those colleges and universities and conference and the NCAA. And I think those private entities, let's call them teams, with owners, will operate in a system under something like conferences in the NCAA, although likely structured a little differently. And the key identity of athletes in the major sports will be as professional players, not students, at least in football and basketball. That sound familiar to you guys?
Sure does. Don, before we go, I have to ask you the question that everybody I know is asking each other this morning. What are your men's Final Four pick?
Yeah, well, there you go. That's why we call it March Madness. It's been a difficult time for the basketball committee. I think we may just have a repeat of 2008, mm-hmm. where all four number one seeds, UConn, UNC, Houston, and Purdue, make it to the Final Four, and we may just have our eighth back-to-back champion with UConn getting the repeat. And on the women's side, I'm picking LSU, South Carolina, Stanford, and USC with, of course, my LSU Tigers to win it all. Go Tigers.
What could be more fun?
But, hey, I'm not a bracketologist, nor am I a gambler. So if your listeners are listening to this, don't follow my lead.
What could be more fun than another LSU, South Carolina game on the women's side? Those teams really go at it. Don, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
On February 29th, Metropolitan Theaters filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. This is of great significance to Park City, as the Metropolitan owns both the Holiday Village and Redstone 8 theaters. So is Park City about to become a cinematic desert? On the phone to help us understand how Chapter 11 works and how things might play out here is bankruptcy expert Tom Beckett of Parsons Beal Law Firm. Tom, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Nice to be on.
Let's start with some bankruptcy basics. Why would a company like this file?
This is COVID. Recall when COVID struck, the theaters shut down. And the theaters opened up within a year, but during that time, everyone got used, I think, to small screens, right? Mm-hmm. And so while other businesses have recovered better than theaters have theaters nationwide are still about 20% below where they were before. Their leases didn't change. They still owe the same amount. For Metropolitan, it's about $2.5 million a year in rent that they pay to the entities who own the theaters. Metropolitan operates them, doesn't own the theaters. The rent stays the same. And so Metropolitan has been losing money, about $3 million in the first 9 months last year.
So they are undergoing, obviously, tremendous financial stress. You know, we've noticed that even here, the theaters here in the Park City area don't even open in the daytime anymore. They only open in the evenings. What are the implications of filing? Let's talk about what happens when a company files for bankruptcy and how does this process proceed?
Well, the first thing that happens when a company files bankruptcy is called the automatic stay. It's an injunction against creditors harassing or suing or trying to collect from the company that files. The intent is to give the, we call them debtors in bankruptcy, the debtor a breathing spell, a chance to regroup. One of the things that a debtor in bankruptcy has to do is make a decision with respect to all of its leases, whether it wants to assume those leases or reject them. It makes those decisions, the leases that are above market, it'll reject, and those that are below market, it'll assume. And that's part of its formulation of a reorganization plan. And if the creditors in the court approve its plan, then the debtor emerges as a reorganized company, either with less debt or with less lease obligations, whatever it takes to get it on its feet again.
And is it correct to assume that the theaters are likely to operate normally, at least in the short term?
Yes, for a couple of reasons. One, that's kind of the genius of Chapter 11. A Chapter 11 bankruptcy is intended so that the debtor with its breathing spell gets to continue the ordinary course of its business. Now, the one thing I want to point out here is that the company in Los Angeles that filed bankruptcy does not operate Redstone or Holiday. One of its subsidiaries does. And that subsidiary did not file bankruptcy. So it's like the grandfather, not the parent, of these theaters has filed bankruptcy. It makes these theaters bankruptcy adjacent. But since the operator of those theaters, these theaters in Park City, has not filed bankruptcy, there's no immediate threat that a debtor could terminate the lease or reject it.
So this is interesting. We have the solvent or non-bankrupt child of a bankrupt parent. That means that they're going to continue to have to pay the full rent every month, I take it, for both theaters. Why is that something that Metropolitan would be willing to continue? Why wouldn't they want to put this subsidiary into bankruptcy and get that protection?
You're making an assumption, Roger, that the lease is above market. We don't know that that's the case. We it's safer to assume that the fewer people are going to movies. We've seen that, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so revenue is down, but we don't know the terms of that lease, so we don't know whether it's above or below market.
So that might even explain why they made that decision. In other words, if they looked at it and said, hey, we don't mind these leases, therefore we're not going to file, is that possibly how that thought process would have worked?
That's one explanation, and I will offer another one.
Sure.
In the bankruptcy case, papers say that the parent company has guaranteed the debt of the subsidiary that operates these two theaters. So if the subsidiary were to file bankruptcy, that could have a couple of effects. It would trigger the guarantee obligation of the parent, and that would substantially increase its debt. And we don't know by how much. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to stray into too much minutia, but one important aspect of this particular case is that it is filed under Chapter 11, but a small business provision of Chapter 11, which we call Subchapter 5. And a Subchapter 5 bankruptcy has an eligibility amount in terms of how much your debt is. It's $7.5 million. If you have more than $7.5 million in debt, you can't proceed under Subchapter 5. The parent is in Subchapter 5. And there are a number of advantages of that over a typical Chapter 11. And it could be that putting the subsidiary in increases its debt beyond its eligibility. I don't know.
So I want you to do a little role-playing game for us, Tom. We've got these different parties and sort of talk about how the dynamics work in a typical case, not necessarily this one, between we've got creditors, we've got the equity, and I think this is a privately owned family company, and we've got leaseholders. How do these people sort of negotiate? How do they, what are each of them trying to do, and what role does the court ultimately play?
I'll start with a comment about debt and equity, if I can. Okay. Ordinarily, in the non-bankruptcy business world, everyone understands that the management of a company owes a fiduciary duty to the owners, the equity. That changes as a matter of law when the company becomes insolvent. And certainly, when it's officially in a bankruptcy proceeding. Management then owes a fiduciary duty not to the owners, but to the creditors. In this case, you have management. It's a family-run business, Metropolitan. Management is the owners, and so they're going to have to be very careful to put the creditors' interests ahead of those of themselves. So in a typical Chapter 11, not a Subchapter 5, a branch of the Justice Department called the U.S. Trustee's Office will ask creditors if they want to form a committee. And so there's a committee of creditors, and their lawyers and their accountants and their investment bankers are paid for by the debtor. So that's pretty expensive. The idea is, instead of having a whole bunch of unsecured creditors coming in and arguing on their own behalf, you have a committee of creditors, and their fiduciary duty is not to their own claim, but to the best interests of creditors generally. So typically, those are the parties to the bankruptcy. You have the debtor and you have the committee, and they both owe their duties to the creditors generally. And together they work out a plan, solve some of the problems, and work out a plan, and then put that plan out for a vote by all the creditors. If the plan is approved, then the judge looks at the bankruptcy code and determines that the plan comports with the bankruptcy code, which is really fairly technical. And in the meantime, there are 100 different little fights that break out that the judge has to decide. In a Subchapter 5, there is no committee, so the debtor is spared that expense. And instead, an individual, typically a lawyer, will act as the Subchapter 5 trustee. And he or she is kind of an ombudsman who watches over everything, advises the debtor, settles disputes with creditors, and moves the debtor along to completing a plan. In a Chapter 11, it can take years to confirm a plan. In a Subchapter 5, the dust should pretty much have settled after 90 days. A plan has to be proposed within 90 days. So it happens much quicker.
Let's talk a little bit, just a little bit about the dynamics here, which is I'm a creditor. I'm owed X dollars. And now we have this filing. I obviously want to get as much as I can, you know, on my debt. Is the dynamic here that if I try to get too much, the company goes under, it goes into liquidation, and I end up getting less? Is that sort of trying to walk that rubber band of tension to try to figure out what's the most I can get without causing the company to liquidate, because then I'll probably get less? Have I basically got that right?
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the tests for confirming a plan is the debtor has to show that its continued existence is better for the creditors than its immediate liquidation. And so it may be giving the creditors stock or notes or, you know, some future promise, but it needs their vote to confirm the plan. So it's got to persuade them that reorganization is better than liquidation. Otherwise, the creditors say, you know, let's get this over with. Let's pull off the Band-Aid. Let's just liquidate it. And that happens quite a lot.
Tom, are you seeing other sort of theater chains suffering similar kinds of liquidity problems in as you look around the bankruptcy world?
Yes, but I want to make a comment here. When the pandemic began, when COVID hit, a lot of people thought, oh, Lordy, it's going to be bankruptcies all over the place. And instead of rising, bankruptcies fell to about 35-40% of their prior rates. Personal bankruptcies fell much faster. And business bankruptcies took about a year and a half or two to bottom out. In the last 2 years, bankruptcies have been increasing, but generally, they're still only about 70% of where they were very consistently for 4 years before COVID hit. I think my own view is that has baked in a lot of inefficiency. And the expectation is that bankruptcies will rise back to what we call normal and then exceed normal. And theater chains may very well be part of that. And there was part of the explanation for the dearth of bankruptcies was there was so much money pumped into the system. And that money still hasn't run out.
One side question, because you've done a really good job of describing bankruptcy with Chapter 11, but then also the Subchapter 5. I like the idea that Subchapter 5, they have to put a plan together within 90 days, but you've also brought up some scenarios where they may need to expand out of Subchapter 5, out of the small business designation. If they were to go into just regular bankruptcy, there's no timetable. Is that correct?
It's less strict. Under a normal Chapter 11, it's 180 days to propose a plan, and not uncommonly that deadline is extended.
Okay.
If the deadline isn't extended, the only thing that happens is that the debtor can file a plan. Anyone can file a plan. It's the rule is only the debtor can file a plan for the first 180 days.
We've been speaking with Tom Beckett of Parsons Bailey. Tom, thanks so much for spending time with us. We may ask you to come back when this thing resolves itself. And meanwhile, we'll all be watching. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Co-founder Rena Vanzo wants women to head into the boob bus for their annual mammogram, get genetic testing, treat themselves to cosmetic procedures that can boost their confidence, or all of the above. Whether through private parties with besties or state health contracts supporting underserved populations, the Boot Bus's vision is a world where no woman misses her mammogram. Joining us this morning to talk more about this business is Rena Vanzo. Rena, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're excited to hear about this. Let's begin. Tell us, how did the idea for the Boot Bus begin?
So it was about 2 years ago in the spring of 2022, and I had just turned 40 years old. So many of the women listening know that that means you should be booking your first mammogram, having that first breast cancer screening. And I did that. And I was also at an area of my life where my career was kind of in a crossroads. And I was thinking about this mammogram. I was really anxious for it because I have a number of family members with breast cancer. So I was nervous. I was seeking out kind of that support from my community and family members. What do I expect out of this? What can I be doing to prepare for it? And I realized that, wow, this would be a good business if women could actually support each other in this process. You could go somewhere that felt really welcoming and inviting, get the information you're seeking, and have that exam done that women tend to put off.
The website has a number of frequently asked questions, and my favorite was, the Boob Bus. Isn't that name a little unsavory? What was your response?
Yeah, it's something I knew that we had to talk about. It definitely is a name that creates a little tension. You know, this conversation is really fun, but I want to recognize that the name is not for everyone. And and there are going to be some women who don't want to come to us just on that principle alone. And that's okay. But my co-founder and I, you know, early on, we had some, I would say, friendly debates about the name and talking to people in the community, talking to many of the instructors in the program I'm a part of, the Masters of Business Creation program, and people had concerns about this. So we did our due diligence. We created some surveys. We talked to a number of people. And I'm really glad that we stuck with the name because we want to combat these dire breast cancer statistics. You know, Utah is one of the third lowest states in terms of mammogram compliance. Mm-hmm. Breast cancer is the second leading cause of death among women in this nation. And we want people to be screening and talking about this. And we needed a name that really matched that kind of energy and that matches the impact that we want to have on the community. And let's face it, most people that hear the Boob Bus have their interest piqued, and they're going to go look it up, and they're going to talk about it. And that transcends genders, by the way. Men men are looking it up, too. And I think that's
probably
a
for a different
thing,
agenda,
you know?
But that's neither here nor there.
Hey, that may be, but at least they get in the door and then they're thinking about it. I mean, we had an event. It was at the Utah Grizzlies Fight Cancer weekend a month ago, and I had two or three men walk on the bus and say, hey, can my wife come in here and do a mammogram? And so it also just seems more approachable and more friendly than, you know, Mammomobile or Mammograms on Wheels. I mean, those things are unoriginal. And so I think this really does invite people into the conversation, and that's exactly what we want.
You described your own situation when you went to go for your mammogram, and you have built the Boob Bus to provide a complimentary services. Can you talk about what services you provide and why you chose those?
Yeah, absolutely. The mammogram is standard. It's a specialized x-ray that every single woman should be getting yearly after she turns 40. And that's regardless of the result each year. You know, you got to go every single year. That's the best way to detect breast cancer when it's in the early stages, while it's most treatable. So we wanted to create that environment for that purpose. But something I don't think the community is talking enough about is the fact that almost half of women have something called dense breast tissue. It's abbreviated DBT. And there are four categories, type A, B, C, or D. It has nothing to do with a woman's cup size, the shape of her breasts, how they look, how they feel. It simply has to do with the number of glands and fibers and fat nodules in her breast tissue. And this is genetically driven. And the important thing is when a woman has dense breast tissue, which is type C or D, mammograms cannot see all of the concerning findings that can be cancerous, that can become cancerous. And so this is now in women's mammogram reports. And I had that experience. I had my first mammogram, you know, a couple of weeks later, I get this letter in the mail that says, you know, nothing was seen, but the sensitivity of the mammogram is lower because you have dense breast tissue. And I was like, what does that mean? Who do I need to talk to? What do I do now? And so it came out of left field. I wasn't expecting that. I didn't even know what that meant. And then also it left me with, well, what do I do now? What do I do next? I only knew about the mammogram. And so we have a dense breast ultrasound machine. We're actually the only bus in the nation that has both the mammogram and the dense breast ultrasound. And so women have been calling and they've been saying, oh my gosh, I've been trying so hard to get this. There are only a few other dense breast ultrasound units in Utah, you know, within hospital systems. And so they can be hard to get, they can be pricey to get. And so it is our, you know, goal to really educate women about this potential result. And then also to let them know during their mammogram, we have technology that tells the technician right then and there, which of those four types of women's tissue is, so she can add on that ultrasound. And then the radiologist has the benefit of reading both exams together and giving a more comprehensive result that brings more peace of mind to that woman.
I just have to say that prevents a second visit, which is typically what that takes.
Yes.
And that's amazing.
Yes, that's right.
As a financier, I have to ask, to what extent do you have arrangements with insurance companies for payment on these kinds of services?
And it's not just somebody who's in finance asking that. I mean, that is the first question that I get asked when women call is, do you take my insurance? And as a brand new provider, we just got the bus in February. I actually tried last year getting network contracts with all of the local and national mm-hmm. payers. But this is a very structured process. I had to have the bus first so that I could have the state credentials, the federal licenses to operate. So I've restarted that process in February. I've got applications in with those insurers, and it is, some of them say 30 days, some of them say 120 days. So I'm unfortunately in that difficult waiting period. But I have made the business decision to go ahead and accept insurance, even though they may consider me out of network. I've been writing letters to the insurance companies for each patient I'm seeing, you know, asking, recognizing, hey, I'm not in your network yet. That process is pending. I would like to be considered in network for Jane Doe's exams. Here's why. This is what we offer. And I've had relative success getting those requests approved. So this, you know, this is a process. Some of these insurance companies will backdate my effective date to when I submitted the applications. So ultimately, I don't want payment to be a barrier for women. I mean, I have to think about what's right and what's going to work for my business, but it's also really important for me to get these customers and get these women in the door, because I'm a firm believer that once they have this experience with us in this very inviting, educational, supportive environment, that, by the way, they can book with a friend, you know, their mom, their sister, their best friend can be there in the waiting room when they come out, you know, so women can really do this, quote, together, even though the exam itself is private. But I want to get them in the door. And I believe that once they're a client of ours, that we will continue to earn their business year over year. So that's how the mammograms are working. We are billing insurance for those. But then unfortunately, the dense breast ultrasound is not something that is being reimbursed consistently in Utah yet. There's some legislation that's hoping to change that. And some states have been successful there, but that is an out-of-pocket cost. I also offer genetic testing, saliva kits for breast and ovarian, colon, pancreatic, other cancer risk. That's my background, is in genetics. So that is a self-pay service. And some women are booking private parties for their communities, and we offer some cosmetics such as Botox, skin fillers, and those elements are also cash pay. So there is kind of this combination and diversified revenue streams coming in.
Rena, we've got about 20 seconds left. Can you let the listeners know how they can find out more about the Boob Bus?
Absolutely. They can go to www.theboobbus.com to learn more. They can also call 866-747-BOOB.
Even better. Rena Vanzo, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.